Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here. We're broadcasting live from the EU Parliament, and we'll be joined very shortly by MEP Maria Walsh of Fine Gael, and we're going to talk about how this place works and what MEPs do here as well. Some of your comments coming in. I understand that 300,000 Ukrainians have now been killed, along with 160,000 Russians, says a listener, which comes to close to 500,000 in total. Can Parliament intervene to put an end to the rising toll? Well, you heard from our two earlier guests in relation to that. Ireland is facing a disaster with housing. Our government were stuck because of EU policy re-Airbnbs, and our boats can't fish in our own water. It feels like Ireland is being punished for Brexit. There is a sense out there, whether it's provable or not, that our fishing rights were a key sacrifice, you could say, to getting Brexit over the line. There is that view out there. As it relates to the Airbnbs, I don't know. I'm not sure everyone wants that Airbnb policy to come in Ireland, but we shall see. Another person says the left are destroying the country. Lisbon Treaty made us vote twice because they didn't like the first answer. Another, at this stage, I'd rather be poorer than have open borders policy and see our children being able to build homes and raise families, not to leave our shores to other countries. Now, the one thing I will say on that, and perhaps it's not for me to say, the housing crisis, the difficulties in people being able to build on their own lands, the provision of housing, that all, the problem, I think everyone can see there's a problem there, predates anything that happened in the last couple of years, but I understand your point of view. Another huge respect for Luke Ming Flanagan. And other people have to keep their thinking as clear as possible when making decisions. I think what is wrong in Russia is being isolated, and that is not going to solve anything. I think we need to look back to the Cuban Missile Crisis and see how a major war was averted there. Another, why is the UN not having more of a say in finding a solution? What is their role in this? What is the opinion of Hunter Biden in the Ukraine and the discovery of his laptop? I'm not sure that's of a huge concern to the people of Ukraine, but I appreciate your text. I very much agree with Luke Ming, talking a lot of common sense. Another, Greg, does the pub open on a Good Friday? Just let's intervene in the European conversation. I'm not sure. I thought that was done away with. Caroline will probably be able to tell me, do the pubs open on Good Friday? If not, Kevin certainly will. My daughter, Shauna McLaughlin, is in Brussels with Carn Donoghue Community School. I want to thank the school and staff who made the trip possible. The students are having a great time. We're listening from Malin this morning, in from her mum. Where are they? It's a shame we couldn't have got a couple of students from Carn Donna on. Okay, the time is 12 minutes past 10. You're very welcome along to this special 9 till noon show, broadcasting live here from the EU Parliament in Brussels. If you have any questions on the workings of the EU, its role, its future, get in touch with us, 086 60 25000, or call 07491 25000. Listen, we were delighted to welcome the invite to come here, because a lot of the decisions that impact on your lives are made here. And I just feel, as of late, and I'm joined now by MEP Maria Walsh, I just feel that, and it's not down to the likes of yourself, you publish plenty of press releases, and maybe it's down to the likes of us that maybe don't publish as much of them as we possibly should. I just get a sense that maybe 7, 8, 9 years ago, my timings are all off, maybe it's 10 years ago, I don't know, that it felt like, you know, our MEPs were more part of the news cycle with councillors and TDs. You work with lots of different radio stations and papers. Do you find it hard to get your stuff out there?
Yes, I find it, first and foremost, welcome to the European Parliament. I do find it difficult.
Beautiful. You look great on camera there, Caroline, just walking. Oh, did you? Right, okay. Go ahead.
Note that he requested his coffee at 11, whatever it is. He's very demanding here since he stepped into the Parliament.
I don't know where I learned it from.
But to answer your very serious question, I do. And I remember over the 2019 campaign speaking with people asking, I mean, fundamentally, I put my hand up and got involved based off asking 10 friends, multiple reasons why, but this was really the catalyst for me. 10 friends across various networks in my life saying, what does an MEP do and who's your MEP? And 9 of them came back saying, I don't know. So the conversation then became quite big for me in terms of, why is there a disconnect? And then you run, you get elected, fortunately. And my team and I do, like all MEPs, multiple work in trying to make the piece of what happens in Europe, what happens in Ireland, and make that piece a little bit more connected. And it's a really hard sell to sell, which is incredibly sad.
I do want to put hands up and think the media have a significant role in that, because as I say, the MEPs are out here, they have press people, they're accessible, you know, pretty good. You're very accessible, but I mean, across the board, Luke Ming, we've spoken to, and others. And I just think I think the likes of ourselves and others perhaps need to do a bit more. Mm. And that's not doing anyone a disservice if there's journalists listening that do lots of it. I don't mean it like that. I'm sort of making it as an overview.
I would imagine, and this is from speaking to you and your team, and then many living in communities, you know, what happens in Europe seems very far away. Mm-hmm. I think our lads and ladies at a national front don't do us any service either. And I tell this to my party all the time. You know, if it's good day, it's coming from national
because
funding,
it might be
propped and supported by EU funding.
And sometimes, you know, it's phrased, and I don't want to talk about any particular TDs because I think it's across the board, and I think it will be across all parties, which is ever. Sometimes it suits them, even though maybe the EU has had a role in the positive news. It's like the big bad wolf, we took them on and we won, which doesn't do you many favours.
It does, and it actually does a disservice to democracy here. And we have 30 MEPs while we're a small country, hopefully more in
14
next year.
Maybe,
And while we're a small country, we play a very big role in democracy building in various political parties right across the EU. And that really needs to be recognised. Mm. Plus, we hold a multiple EU positions as a small country. You know, I heard MEP Flanagan speak of Tony Murphy, Court of Auditors president, like a phenomenal role to be sitting in. But the cell is often very difficult at home, which is frustrating. But where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. Now, you know, I mean, you get the sense that what does the EU do? It's taking away our fishing. It's taking away, it's trying to take away our farming. It's taking away our cars. It's taking away our turf, you know, like... That's I think a perception that's out there. I mean, is that a fair, like, what I presume all these same conversations are happening in every other country as well?
Yes, from the fishing, I do agree, and I know a previous text had come in around that decades ago.
The '70s. I know that we sold our fishing rights, and certain names will be mentioned. I mean, that happens every time we have a talk about fish.
And we have to be fair to that, and we have to be there. You can't pivot around what has happened. But what, in my eyes, the EU and us being here, and the EU being within the Irish legislation and community, for me is, you know, this year we celebrate our 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. The removal of the marriage bar was, as a young female, our first step into what equality feels like. We still have a long way to go. Just this morning, I was debating equal pay for equal work.
This is the marriage bar that's still leaving women very shortchanged in terms of pensions.
Absolutely.
So we've made progress, but we still have the hangover.
But you could do that in various sectors. You know, when you look at the just to finish off in terms of equal pay for equal work, 50 years on, we're still trying to make that work. Other countries in the EU buy into it, some don't. For us, and for me as a young representative from the west of Ireland, I think it's incredibly important. Now the next iteration is making sure the pension pay gap is removed, so that we don't continue to have generations left out from access to opportunity or financial security. When you take it agriculture, I mean, while it has its good pros and indifference, and I know MEP Flanagan, and I believe you're going to speak to MEP Markey later on, two reps from the Agriculture Committee, you know, for us, we also can't be ignorant to the fact that we have received billions of funding to make sure the likes of farm safety is there, the likes of access to land for our young farmers is there. A hell of a lot more work to do, but it certainly has given us a space to develop our side of the country. And I think that's incredibly important. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's important to be critical, but we need to be fair within that critic.
And I'm not saying it's separate to it. I think a lot of conversation about farming at the moment is that, you know, farming, yes, it is a major contributor to the climate problem, but it seems almost fashionable to blame it all on farmers. And then it pitches the society against farmers, not society, sorry, picks those who aren't in farming against the crying farmers. And sometimes I think I think it suits the decision makers to sow those seeds, you know, to get things across the line. Because if you're criticizing a farmer, you're not criticizing maybe the person that's actually making the decision.
Well, fundamentally, I've stressed this so many times before, you know, farming is not to blame. We are in a crisis of food security long before the war against Ukraine started. We have a lack of equality when we come to payments across the country, across the EU. And I think for a country that is golden standard in produce, we as consumers need to adapt and understand that food doesn't come from shelves. While we might buy it there, it certainly comes from really hard work. But I think farmers, I was on a farm in Kildare just Monday. Farmers are trying to be innovative. And we need to make sure here as representatives that we're removing as much red tape as we can for them to do exactly what they've been doing for generations. Similar to our fishermen and women. I mean, they've been the custodians of our green and blue landscapes for decades. So we've got to get them to do their job, should they wish to do it.
And I think, you know, even if it felt like, you know, the EU was working with fishers to some extent, because you might be familiar with the fact that at the moment, they might still be in the waters. We had two of the world's biggest fish factories, which have been responsible for mass fish kills off the Spanish coast, for an example. And we have them fishing in Irish waters, decimating stocks, not just the stocks that they're fishing. Now, the logical thing would be to say, right, OK, well, you have the quotas, but you need to fish them in smaller boats with smaller nets because it's more green, it's more sustainable, right? So if you're a fisher that can't get into those waters and you see what's going on and you know it's actually really, really poor environmental practice, it's very frustrating. And, and I think it wouldn't be really hard to sort of, you know, sort those type of things out, the common sense stuff, Maria.
Yeah, the low-hanging fruit, as we say. Absolutely, and I agree. And as we move towards more pressure on the fisheries with deals with Norway and making sure that other boats are not coming in, we need to do... That's why it's incredibly important here in the Parliament that when we are making one deal, we're not jeopardising the livelihoods of another. I completely agree with you.
So before we get on to some other talking points, here, and as I say, I want listeners to get involved. 086 60 25,000. So, I think too, what people struggle with is where decisions are made and how it works, right? So, you're going to break it down into simple man terms for me here,
and
right?
If anybody knows the answer, will you please text it
as soon as you can. No, but you know, so decisions are made in Europe, right? And then they're interpreted, enforced by government, or what way? How does a decision making Europe end up affecting a person in a European nation?
Yeah, well, from an Irish standpoint,
an example,
about 70% of legislation changes at home in Ireland come from here. So we have our council, our commission, and then our parliament. We're elected officials, 705. The seats will increase. So we briefly mentioned there's whispers Midlands Northwest, which is Galway to Donegal, Mayo, across to Louth, will see an extra seat. I certainly welcome that. And the fact that we've probably one of the biggest constituencies in Europe, given we're half the size of the country. So 705 get elected. Our commission, which is where Commissioner McGuinness sits on Ireland's behalf, represents and puts forward a number of work programmes. And they're like the bridge between what we as elected officials here in the Parliament in terms of scrutiny around legislation, what they put forward and ideas coming in with our own ideas also and what our communities that we represent want. And then the council, which is where our Taoiseach and Taoiseach and other senior ministers sit and debate and discuss. And then you have within all of that, obviously civil servants, our diplomats, a number of interest groups and folks like yourself who are trying to cover and make sure it fundamentally makes sense to the people that's going to be impacting.
Do you think we're vocal enough as a nation at these council meetings in terms of, you know, protecting Irish interests? Sometimes it feels that we want to be good boys and girls, that we don't want to upset the apple cart, that we realise we're a relatively small player. Maybe we don't invoke any vetoes that we may or may not have. Do you know what I mean?
I actually think, to that point, I know know, I think we're a bit biased here as I represent the country, but
that, yeah.
I think we're incredibly important at the decision making table in terms of bridge building. And as I mentioned, since 73, we have multiple seniors and hopefully more junior workers coming through the institutions that are absolutely impacting the way countries are moving and driving their own growth. And I think people look to Ireland and our leaders to say, in 50 years, look at where this country has gone. When you think our now third country, our divorcee from across the channels has left, and the belief system perhaps in when that vote came in 2016, well, Ireland will be next, and we're not. We've stepped into a role of great senior.
It had to be made very difficult for the British to ensure that, though, that we didn't see a day like Italy. Probably were watching on with great interest to see how the whole Brexit thing went.
Yeah, but
so
I think, but I think the likes
having
of
them queue in a special lane, obviously, you know,
I think the likes of Hungary and Poland, and we've discussed before too, in terms of this extremism or this pendulum swing that we're seeing right across politics as a whole across the world, not just in Europe. But but to answer your question in terms of us, we're not meek, and we're not shy about making our point heard, and we never. I really believe this. I can say this as a Fine Gaeler. We never leave a table when decisions need to be made, and I think that's a powerful tool for us.
What was your view? You talked about us being bridge builders, and perhaps it wasn't in this context necessarily, but what was your view? And we talked a little bit about it in the first hour. What was your view in Leo Varadkar, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, said, talking about our neutrality, that we have to look at our neutrality, using words like, you know, we need to stop Putin in his tracks, right? How does that make you feel?
Well, this is where I differ to some of my Fine Gael colleagues. I believe our conversation, we need a conversation around neutrality. I don't think we'll ever change as a country in terms of being a strong defence force.
But what do you mean we need a conversation? Because the way you talked about that, it's almost posed as if we need to talk about, you know, watering down on neutrality. Maybe that's not how you meant it.
No, I
think a lot of the public, a lot of people listening to watching this programme actually want to talk about how do we strengthen our neutrality? How do we actually become politically neutral, perhaps? Because, you know, I can imagine this scenario where we obviously we're not going to go shaking hands with everyone and do anything inappropriate, right? But, I mean, we have the Good Friday Agreement coming up for discussion later here. You know, we could say we're a neutral country. We condemn what's happening in Ukraine, but we've seen how things can be brokered. Mm-hmm. We've got this experience, like, and actually become, set ourselves as the peacemakers.
Yeah.
We're saying Putin must be stopped in his tracks. Now, when Leo Varadkar says that to the rest of Europe, he is speaking for every single person in Ireland. That's what the listener hears. We know differently at home. I just think it's such a lost opportunity. Why are we going down that route? We don't want to be part of a European army. We don't want to get involved in overseas stuff. We want, I think, and recent polls have showed, we want to maintain and even maybe strengthen our neutrality and not have a conversation about how it's watered down.
Well, I believe this is where I believe this conversation needs to go. And again, I only represent myself in this. I don't want to put words in my other Fine Gael colleagues' mouths. We are a small island, the most west periphery of our European Union. We see from the movement online in terms of cybersecurity that we are not at the races when it comes to protecting that island. We see boats off the coast and air force off the coast of particularly in the west where we're from, from other countries, in particular Russia. And we have not funded the defense force, in my belief, for generations to the standard it needs. That if anything was to change tomorrow morning, we do not have enough men and women and others in the positions they need to fulfill the obligations of what they've trained to do in terms of defence force. That's not brokering or changing our belief system and our constitutional belief on neutrality.
Really but there's nothing we could do or no amount of money we could invest that would offer any resistance if Russia decided to use Ireland as a launch point. That's a really sad sentiment to say.
But the belief system. But I argue that, Greg, with we are a part of a European Union, and if Russia was to invade,
for a European army,
no, I wouldn't be. But I also think there's some narrative that often gets put out, particularly by the left, that. When we talk about EU army, it's our men and women in the same uniform marching across mainland Europe. And actually, in my eyes, that couldn't be further from the truth. We have to become very sophisticated when it comes to cyber security. We have a number of individuals being trafficked throughout the EU, in Ireland in particular, about 1,000. And we have no way of... In my belief, really seeing the detail of how those individuals, particularly young women and children, being trafficked. We also have a war very close to Europe and our European Union. We have to get really real about that. And we have men and women who have played, to your point earlier, as peacemakers in third countries, and they do a service. And they need to be in terms of. Pay remuneration, in terms of retention of staff, in terms of retraining and consistently getting ready for what could come. It doesn't diminish our neutrality, but it certainly makes us, we have to become aware of the fact that we have a war within a very short space of us. And we are seeing the aftermath. So I don't know.
It's complex.
And I think
the listeners will be able to make up their minds. 0866 25,000 WhatsApps and texts, that number. We're in the company here of MEP Maria Walsh. We've got more guests as well. We'll have more from Maria shortly. We've got more guests on the way as well. So any questions, EU questions, whatever, as I say, you know, I believe the media's responsibility to come out here as well and talk about what happens here and how it impacts us. So that's what we're trying to do. We'll be back after a break with more from the 9 till noon show, or the 10 to 1 show as it's known here in Brussels. MEP Maria Walsh in just a couple of minutes. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio, live from the EU Parliament in Brussels. And we're still in the company here of Maria Walsh, who is MEP for Fine Gael. Did we talk about equality and the hate directive, Maria? Was there something you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, from the pay transparency piece, I just wanted to really share... As we mentioned earlier, the 50 years since we joined the EU in terms of that marriage bar removal and women really being celebrated for being 50% of our workforce. Yeah. So as of tomorrow, we will get a final vote on equal pay for equal work directive, and that will see things like pay secrecy being removed. So when you see a job being posted, you will see the band of which the pay on offer from that company
will
is going to be.
Across the board, or just companies of certain size?
It will be across the board. In terms of pay reporting, we will see companies with 250 employees more reporting the differences of pay for the first year, and then it reduces it, what we call a staircase model. And what I'm really encouraging is while SMEs, our small businesses, and our entrepreneurs are not a part of this directive, I would really encourage, given we are a land of entrepreneurship, that we have small businesses really celebrating that too, because it's important as we scale our businesses also that we are really at the forefront as a country in our European Union, understanding that equal pay for equal work is absolutely necessary in order for us to look at pension rights.
It's really amazing. I sometimes have these conversations and I think we've come so far, and then you realise really there's such a distance to go, isn't there?
I mean, and we could pivot to inside, 400 odd days, we're going to see local and European elections again.
Can't wait.
Yeah, look, he's so excited.
No, I do actually. I do enjoy it.
But we'll see local and European elections. We'll see, no doubt, a general election, hopefully after that. We'll see a referendum on the constitution line in terms of a woman's role in the home. Yeah. It's incredibly important that we hear from female voices at a political level, at business level, at community level, and that we really begin to really shift future generations.
I think we are doing amazing in Donegal, and I hope I'm not doing anyone, I hope I'm not sort of holding any efforts back. Other than elected representation, like, we are doing amazing. I think women are doing amazing things in Donegal in terms of business, business networks. We have our own managing director here, CEO here, Fionnuala Rabbit, head of the Letterkenny Chamber, strong female representation on that. And the list goes on and on and on. The only thing we're missing now is women in the council chamber, which inevitably would bring a different dynamic to the conversation. Actually, diversity, right? Let me spread it out a little bit, because I think any governing institution, if that's what a council is, should as much as possible represent the people it makes decisions for. Mm-hmm. How, you know, because you can't talk about people, you have to talk to them, you can't make decisions for people, they have to be part of the decision making process. Yeah. And I don't understand how there's some resistance to that.
I know.
People are afraid?
Well,
I don't know.
I don't know if it's resistance.
There is.
But I don't know if it's resistance within ourselves or within the wider scope. And I say that is, we also have to, as women, make sure we're putting our name forward, which I have to say.
Well, are you putting your name forward for the next European elections? Have you made a call on that yet?
I'm certainly getting ready for it. Okay. But as you often share, it's a long week in politics, so a long year in it too. But
you personally would intend to go again, but obviously it depends what happens at home too, and if another seat becomes available in Northwest, and then they have to look at it strategically and see where the balance is and all that type of stuff.
And
right?
then you got to let the chips fly. But from my side, my team and I are very much
huge team, folks. Yeah, 40 people.
No, live disinformation.
The amount of money here is crazy.
But to your point, I'm ignoring that.
It's a very small, well-organized team.
To your point, when we look at the need for more supports for our carers in our communities, when you look at the need for more business voices from a female side, or minority groups, as you very kindly shared, in terms of LGBTI community, people of colour, people who weren't born in Ireland but are now calling Ireland home, we need to make sure they're around the table.
And the very simple reason for that, you mentioned carers, right? You can talk about nursing.
Yes.
You can talk about a number of different areas that there are serious issues with, and predominantly, it's women that work in these areas. Mm-hmm. Is it predominantly the right word? I think the majority are, right? Yeah.
And they're disproportionately affected because of such.
But that's it. And I don't think that's something that can be ignored. And I don't think it's a coincidence then that they're not as that those areas aren't as much of a focus. So what is life like over here? This would be my worst nightmare. Now, I know people listening will go, well, Marie is well paid and she'll have that pension. But let's park that for a second, because we're all humans here, right? You know, like, I would find it difficult to move away from home. And you've got a great team, don't get me wrong, but there's, you know, that are with you and what have you. But, I mean, there comes a point, which I probably wouldn't be terribly comfortable with, is where you close the door at night, right, and your family's not around you. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Is it tough? Is that part of it? Is that part of it tough?
I think to our chat just now around women in politics, I think this is a real honest conversation where you are a representative, and then obviously representing a team, and then a constituency. But there's times where I live between cars and airports, which sounds more luxurious than it is. But you are predominantly on your own, and making sure that you're covering enough, doing enough. There's always elements of imposter syndrome, or you have pressure from everyone, you know, talking about how tired you look, to you getting weight, to all those gorgeous things that make people. And then to your point, you close the door at night and you're like, wow, my support system is has to be connected to a phone because I don't have them around me. A little bit different, obviously, for local and national politicians.
You can get home with the weekend.
Yeah, and for here at Europe, I mean, I personally split my week in two. You know, I do Thursday to Wednesday sometimes. Monday to Wednesday, sometimes Thursday here in Brussels, and then Thursday to Sunday anywhere across the 13 counties.
And also,
so you're
to
constantly
this city
on the move.
Is it's a fine city, don't get me wrong, but I would say there probably are other cities that it might be easier to live on your own in.
It is. I mean, it's a very transient city, but this is in this great big beautiful building is where I often spend most of my time, and things finish, and then I head home.
I was reminded, by the way, yesterday by a person that you can actually suggest how much you pay for alcohol here for drinks. You can just
as a pioneer, that wasn't
exactly
me. I just want to stress
it's funny when you mention pioneer, because You know, you talked about people might comment about your weight, or you might comment about you looking tired. I hate when someone says you look tired because it makes me feel like, what's wrong with me, right? But people do it innocently. But even as a non-drinker, you have to explain why you don't drink. It's just a choice I've made all my life. But there are a series of go-to questions that people run through because you have to be able to drink.
I know, and I can't wait for this younger generation that are coming up who don't drink and don't drink because of health reasons. Yeah. Or just because their friends didn't, so they never got into it. I can't wait for that generation to represent Ireland on the international scene because as an old horse, it's like that tired of your Irish, so you must drink. Well, no, I'm a proud pioneer. And
we try and advocate as much for young people on the show as well. Mm. Like, the majority of young people don't drink, or don't drink very, very heavily as well. And you know, there was that recent conversation of how we were portrayed in America, you know, around the time of the Oscars. And it's just, I'd love to see that broken down a little bit. Speaking of young people, right, we talk from time to time too about exchange programs and that type of stuff that are funded and organized through here. But if there are young people listening, what kind of career opportunities are there in Brussels, and what kind of a background educationally would they require to come here?
Yeah, thanks for giving space to this too. So we have a number of traineeships, both within MEP's offices, within our political grouping. So as a Fine Gael, I sit within the European People's Party. And then we have the Blue Book traineeships with the Commission and the Council, and they come twice a year. And please contact the office for more specific detail in case my team are probably waving, going, "You're giving the wrong dates." So I just want to make sure I'm giving right information. And then we have the likes of which St. Columba's College in Stranraer, I'll be a part of in Euroscuela, where it's giving space to young people to pick a country, debate and discuss, and really hone in on what we call the soft skills that make politics work, in that bridge building mentality that we talked about earlier. So we have multiple programs like that. Blue Flag program for our primary schools, the EPAS school, so the European Ambassador Schools program for our secondary, often TYers there. And then here, I mean, as I mentioned, the Blue Books, there's so many roles here, and we desperately need to recruit. And I know Minister Peter Burke is really looking at this from a job strategy, because when we joined in 73, we have a number of individuals now set to retire, and we need to make sure we have English and Irish speakers coming through, both for translators, so from legal text, as well as interpreters, and making sure that conversation dialogue happens. So there's multiple. And then you look at the organisations that support our spin-off of the European Union. So, and there's multiple of that in terms of environment, agriculture, fisheries, mental health, social policy. There's so many amazing opportunities. Right. And we have a university in Leuven, not too far from here, that a lot of Irish students work with too. So get in touch with any MEP, but particularly my office, and happy to point you in the right way, because as I mentioned, we could be Irish and European, and we need to make sure all the things we talked about here, that we're breaking that disconnect, because we so badly need to make sure we are part of this big family. Yeah. And we feel part of the family, and it's not just for interrailing or Erasmus Plus, where students are seeing the Europe
that is on their doorstep. Interrailing, that would just be my worst nightmare. You talked about the Irish language though, and of course now it has its official recognition. How significant is that finally, Maria?
Huge. And I think for communities that are listening here in Donegal, particularly in Guidor and in Shone, like, this is a powerful tool to have. I was challenged this past week about why I haven't given a maiden speech in Irish, and I got put to the point where by the end of this mandate I will give. I'm not an Irish fluent speaker, but certainly as an Irish representative I should.
You need to get to Glencolum Kill. It worked very well for your colleague Joe McHugh.
Yeah, and he's a phenomenal Irish speaker now.
I don't know. There's something going on there. I don't know how you can learn the language in a couple of weeks.
But anyway. I think the likes of Colleen Kuhn and the Oscar nom and Irish being here. And
it's cool again too,
it's,
I think.
Fabulous.
Not sure it ever lost its coolness.
No, it's fabulous.
Right,
and it's
okay.
Great that it's given its stage.
Yeah, excellent.
It's most important.
Caller says, women face a harder time in politics. I've seen an awful thread on Twitter about female politicians being scandalised for St. Patrick's Day outfits, not one about the men. It ends up taking the focus of what matters. That's a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, let's not talk about what I'm wearing. Let's talk about my feelings and opinions on something.
I mean, I can tell you this as a young female representative, I've really debated and pushed with my team, mental health services across the EU, equal pay for pensions, LGBTIQI plus rights, which are always on the back foot and are being used as a ping pong politically right now, rural, agricultural women who are doing phenomenal work in their communities, and the list goes on and on. If we don't have women here, or other minority representatives, then we're not a true representation of the 500
Caroline
million.
Is tapping her watch. And
oh, sorry.
That is a woman I certainly respect greatly. So that'll do for me. MEP Maria Walsh, thanks for giving us an insight into your life here, to your life here, and some of the work that goes on here. Been really informative. Caller says, I want to send my children to a Gael school, but I'm afraid I won't be able to support them because I don't have good Irish myself. Well, you know what? That might actually be an interesting feature on the show, separate to what we're doing here, about the practicalities of that, because that's what we try and do. All right, Maria, thank you very much indeed. It is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio, live from the EU Parliament in Brussels. If you have any questions, don't forget on the workings of it. Hopefully we're helping you with some answers here. And anything EU related, we'll try and get those answered for you. We've plenty of guests lined up between now and 12. We're joined in studio now by MEP Sean Kelly and Colm Markey. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Before we get into the Good Friday Agreement, Sean, just a word on you. It's kind of topical because we've just done it again. I can't remember how long ago it is I talked to you about the clocks going backwards and forwards. Is this still a hobby horse of yours?
It is looking like a hobby horse now.
I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just something that you're...
But firstly, thanks for coming out. Which rarely it happens, and Highland Radio deserve every credit for so doing, trying to bring European issues to their listeners, which we appreciate very much. Clock change was nearly achieved in the last mandate. I wasn't very much involved in it over my time here in Parliament, but some countries didn't agree and it needed unanimity. One of them was Ireland. They said that if they changed the system here in this Republic, that the Brits mightn't do so, and that we'd have two different timelines in the Ireland of Ireland. So I don't think that was going to be the case because...
They would have followed.
They would have followed. Yeah. And particularly because in the public consultation done by the Commission, over 83% in the United Kingdom said they wanted clock change to end. So they weren't going to be that pig-headed over Brexit that they just would do the exact opposite to the European
Union. So we're no closer. We were very close, but we're no closer to... stopping this back and forward nonsense.
There is some work going on in different countries to see how we could possibly adjust, and definitely we will have to take it on the agenda as soon as the next Parliament is up and running, because trying to do it now with the Parliament elections next year, you just wouldn't achieve it.
Yeah. Okay, listen, thanks for that. I was just curious as to how things were moving in that regard. Okay, the Good Friday Conference to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreements taking place in Brussels today. Colm, the significance of this? I mean, obviously we know the significance of the Good Friday Agreement, but why marked here?
Well, I think it's to mark the 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement to start with. I think it's very important that we do, because we all see what the benefits it's brought to Ireland. But I think from a European perspective, Europe has had a very positive impact in terms of the Good Friday Agreement and in terms of, if you like, the island of Ireland over the years. And I think we need to recognise that too. And I think the efforts that have been made at this end to even in Parliament has been opened today by a ceremony to recognise the Good Friday Agreement. It's recognised all across Europe, the impact, the positive impact the Good Friday Agreement has. And it's held up as probably one of the most successful peace agreements across the world, really. And I think we need to recognise that. We need to appreciate the importance that Europe holds it in, you know?
Yeah, and Sean, it's not just recognise it. We need to not forget either. I think sometimes, and maybe a new generation aren't aware of what it was like and what it took to get to where we are now, because sometimes you can take... You know, you could take peace for granted, because we've seen recently now the terror level raised in Northern Ireland. We saw the attack on the RUC officer recently. It doesn't take much for us to return to where we once were.
You're absolutely correct. It's a very fragile process. We've had 25 years of peace. Before that, we had 30 years of terror. And we remember those days. And it took an awful lot to get the peace process up and running. And Colm is right. The role of the US is rightly highlighted. the Irish government, the UK government, but not enough has been said about the role of the EU, who are actually funding peace projects in Northern Ireland since 1989. And they had a crucial role, and they're continuing now with the Peace Plus funding of $1.1 billion. And I think the role of the EU is sometimes not appreciated. And also they provided what I would call the diplomatic space, because here in the European Parliament, you had representatives from the different sections in Northern Ireland. You had Ian Paisley, you had John Hume and Jim Nicholson. And when they came out here, they were obviously meeting. They wouldn't probably have met too often. And also they were fighting for the same causes. And I think that was actually creating a certain amount of camaraderie between them that otherwise wouldn't have existed. And without that camaraderie, you probably never have got the Good Friday Agreement. So both in terms of the economic impact and the diplomatic impact, I think the EU played in a very important role.
And obviously in relation to some of those peace-funded programmes, they often have a cross-border, cross-community element to it. There's lots of people listening today that would be involved with or have benefited from them. And that is that those are .EU projects. Colm Markey, there's two panels, isn't there? The first panel, it's a high-level panel it's been described as, including current political leaders, not Michelle O'Neill, who was due to be here but isn't today for one reason or another. I don't know, by the way. And just really people that were involved in getting the Good Friday Agreement over the line.
Yeah, I think it's people who are involved, but it also focuses on the younger generation as well. The like of, for instance, Liam McCurry, who's obviously her father was heavily involved in politics in the North over the years. But I think it's the point that you make. It's important that the next generation recognise as well the impact. Like, I think even just looking back on it from my own perspective, I remember as a kid hearing a rumble, and my mother would take the time with the rumble, and then the news would come on and say that was a bomb in Uri or something like that. So this is very real for one generation. But for the next generation, it may not be. And it's important that it's being young people engage in the importance of it as well. Because if we don't lose sight of it, people will forget.
And do you know, the funny thing is, and I don't mean it that way, Derry Girls probably has done more to educate a generation about the troubles than perhaps maybe schools or politicians or media have done. It's quite interesting, I think, that. What are you looking forward to in the first panel, Sean? And I mean, obviously, you know, if you're going to talk about something, you want to speak to people with influence, people that understand what they're talking about, so it should be good.
It should be very good. We have a great panel, Robbie Butler, the Deputy Leader of the UUP, Caoimhe Archibald from Sinn Féin MLA, Senator Ian McCurry, as Colin mentioned, and Ambassador Lindsay Crosdale-Appleby from British Ambassador to the EU. So we will be discussing the historical background, but more importantly, how we can maintain this into the future, and above all, looking at, I think, asking them, how can the Assembly be guaranteed to function into the future? This on-off cannot continue, and particularly
particularly for the people. You know, whatever about the politics, and you know, there are really big decisions that need to be made.
Absolutely,
they're not being made.
If you elect people to an assembly, you expect the assembly to be up and running. If you elect people to the Dáil, you expect them to form a government. Mm. And I think we will be looking at the Windsor framework. Will it be able to establish enough stability in Northern Ireland so that all the parties can commit to forming an assembly after each election? That would guarantee hugely continuity and stability in Northern Ireland. And of course, they would also be in a position to influence what's been happening in relation to EU law and UK law into the future. But if they're not up and running, obviously, then they don't have any say. So
yeah, OK. And you're of the same view, Colm?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to get the Assembly back up and running. I think that's vital. And I think it leaves a vacuum when it's not there. You would have thought with the agreement, with the Windsor agreement in place, that perhaps that would create the opportunity. But clearly, there's politics in that too. And I suppose that's the bridge we have to cross. But the more communication, the more events like this that recognise the importance of the Good Friday Agreement and the importance of the Assembly, I think, the more hopefully we can put a focus on getting it back.
MEP Sean Kelly, you have to take your leave of us now. You've another appointment. Colm, you've kindly said you'll wait a little after the 11 o'clock news. So what we do have to do is take a break as we head towards that news, and we'll be back with more in a few moments.